to the History Nerds United podcast. I'm your head nerd, Brendan. Thank you so much for being here. Today we have Bethany Hughes with her book, The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. If that name sounds familiar to you, I bet you her face is familiar to you as well. If you're on the History Channel, if you ever watch a history documentary, sooner or later she pops up. She's all over the place. One of my favorite presenters, and I love this book of hers, and The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. She actually, right before this podcast is about to air, she already signed a deal to turn this into a documentary, along with another one about Vikings, which means, once again, she's going to be everywhere. I love this book. Bethany's awesome. How about I shut my mouth and we just get to it? Here we are with author Bethany Hughes, The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, An Extraordinary New Journey Through History's Greatest Treasures. Bethany, thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure. So lovely to chat to you.
I mean, at this point, I should just say the Bethany Hughes, right? I mean, you are an institution at this point, right?
I don't know. I had a rather good thing yesterday that I was booking storage for some furniture I was moving, and I rang the guy and he said, not the Bethany Hughes. And then I had to give him my date of birth. And he said, I promise I'm not going to tell anyone. I was like, no, I don't care. You know, I'm quite proud of it. No, I don't. Oh my gosh, I don't think of myself as that at all. But I do love history and I do a lot of it. So I guess I'm quite a busy Bethany Hughes, if not the Bethany Hughes.
To think that you're kind of the apex, what everyone who really gets into history might be the perfect scenario, which is you get to present on TV, but you're also writing books and all of that stuff. That's got to feel pretty good that you're able to bring history in multiple different ways all the time.
Yeah, I do love it. And it's one of the reasons that I do write the books and that I do the television programs is just I was so aware that there was this wonderful world of ideas and characters and experiences from the past that just wasn't really being shared with a kind of wide audience. When I was doing it, I was at university way back in the 80s. History was really unfashionable then. You know, people saying, who cares? It's irrelevant. All the answers will lie in the future, you know, after the year 2000. And it was a real battle to make people interested in history back then. But that just put fire in my belly and made me think, you know, I know this stuff matters. So for me, yeah, the communicating of history and archaeology is absolutely key. And I adore doing it. And I get a real buzz when people, you know, if I kind of bump into people I was filming in the Caucasus a couple of months ago, and like one of the highest mountains in the Caucasus way out east, and these little kids came up and said, you know, I didn't speak any English, they spoke a sort of dialect of Azerbaijani, and said, oh, we've been watching you on television, we've been watching you. You think, you know, that is reach, that is good if you're managing to hit through to those kinds of people who might not necessarily have the chance to pick up a history book.
Now, I know this is sometimes a hard question to answer. Do you like writing or do you like presenting? Are they so different you can't compare them, or is one of them like really your passion and the other one is something that you really like to do?
I do adore both of them in very, very different ways. I adore writing. I adore the focus and concentration and difficulty, frankly, of communicating an idea or a place or a distance event into a line of text. So I love the kind of discipline of writing. I love how deep you have to dive, how every single sentence matters. I kind of really adore that. But I also only understand history if I travel to the place where it happens. And of course, that's what I do when I'm presenting. So I just, for me as a historian, I cannot write about a place or try to understand a history unless I go and stand on the hillside where a battle raged underneath me, or, you know, on a mountain where a Greek warrior made a proclamation to the rest of his people. I just have to be in the place to feel like I'm truly communicating history. So when I'm filming, that's just basically, I've just got a camera behind me on a massive research trip, you know, through the world. So I'm doing the history thing as I'm presenting and the camera's capturing it. And so I love the physicality of that, as you know, because I deal a lot with ancient history. So ancient Greeks, Romans, Egyptians and beyond. And often it's only the archaeology that you have for those times, not actual written history itself. So you have to go to the places. You have to pick up the pots or run your fingers over, you know, a 2,500-year-old wall, or kind of stands on a mosaic built by Alexander the Great to kind of really get your evidence. It's a really good question. And I love both in very different ways.
Now, the good thing is, my understanding is you were able to get to 6 of the 7 sites of the 7 wonders. Between you and I both, though, we've been to all 7 because I did spend some time in Iraq under wildly different circumstances. But between the two of us, then, we've got them all covered. I have to ask this question. Which one's your favorite? I'm going to send you back in time. You can see one of them at its apex. Which one is the one that you're saying?
I wonder about your Iraq story and hanging, or did you find the Hanging Gardens of Babylon? Because, of course, this is this big mystery. It's the only one of all of the 7, as you know, that we don't exactly know where it is. We don't know whether it was in Babylon or whether it was further north, in 100 miles further north in Nineveh and what's modern day Mosul. So I'd love to, after I've answered the question, have a chat with you about your experience there. Well, I mean, again, I'm sort of not hedging my bets, but I just can't give you one. You know, I love them all like my own children. But I would say, of course, the oldest of the extraordinary wonders of the ancient world is the Great Pyramid of Giza. So it's 4,500, possibly 4,600 years old. And ironically, the only one that is still standing pretty much intact. I mean, it's an incredible thing. If you just think of that distance of time, how sophisticated it must have been, how incredibly well built. I can't actually remember the number of times I've been to the Great Pyramid, and however many times I go, I'm never not awestruck. I'm never not slack-jawed with admiration, astonishment, wonder, at that incredible achievement. So I think you can't not have the Great Pyramid high on your list. But actually, I think possibly one of my favourite, probably the least well-known, which is the Great Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, where there's just kind of one column that remains. You can still go and see it. So this slightly soggy sanctuary, because there's a spring. So when you go, you can hear these kind of frogs and toads making their sweet sound. And so it doesn't look particularly impressive now, but oh my goodness, imagine it again, 2,500 years ago when it was first being properly built and was then visited by Alexander the Great, 2,300 years ago. This temple was twice the size of the Parthenon Temple in Athens. So I think if anybody thinks of an ancient temple, they'll think of that incredible temple on top of the Acropolis Rock. But the Temple of Artemis was 2 times that size, so just enormous. And most Greek temples are based on it. So it's almost like the kind of mothership of Greek temples. But I also love it because it was a place that provided sanctuary to refugees. So it would have had this really interesting atmosphere to it, because Artemis, the Greek and Eastern goddess who becomes Diana in the Roman pantheon, is this ferocious, feisty goddess, the goddess of hunting, who protected wild animals and young girls and young men, not someone to be messed with. But she also offered sanctuary to those who needed it. There was this idea that she would give you protection if you were in distress. And we know that refugees would make their way to this sanctuary, that they were given these kind of dormitories to sleep in. So I think there must have been this incredible atmosphere of gratitude there. And people from across the Near East and Eastern Mediterranean traveling there. And also it was a temple that adored nature, because Artemis, the goddess, adored nature. So I imagine it would have been very kind of fertile and lush and, almost like a sort of paradise garden. So even though that's the one that almost everyone forgets when they try to do the list of the 7 wonders, possibly the one I would most like to go back to see in its heyday.
That one too, as you were just kind of saying, it's one of, I see 2 of them as almost kind of benevolent, right? The Lighthouse at Alexandria, yeah, and this one, whereas the other ones are all about either kind of death or power in and of themselves. I'm jumping back to the Pyramids of Giza. What I find so interesting is, I think the pyramids are by far the longest section of the book, but they're still standing. We can still see these pyramids. We're still learning things like daily about them. And there are still things that even with today's technology, we look at them and we say, I don't know how they did that. And there's just so much more to learn about them, even with them sitting right in front of us, right?
Yeah, completely. I mean, we still don't exactly know how they were built. You're absolutely right. And, we have a better idea now because there's a lot of new archaeology on the Giza Plateau. And because we know that the River Nile was much closer to the base of the Great Pyramid, because it obviously rivers meander and change, and it was also the water content was greater because it hadn't been dammed upstream. So when it flooded, the Nile would be rising 7 meters. And that's a huge amount of water power that would have been used by those great engineers to help kind of raise those giant limestone blocks into place. But as you say, you know, just a kind of mind-blowing achievement, 2.3 million limestone blocks. It's still the heaviest building ever made by human hand, the Great Pyramid, and yet is almost perfect. It's mathematically perfect. Sometimes within, you know, an inch, 2 inches, even 2 centimeters is the only kind of deviation from mathematical perfection. So we have to ask ourselves how they made it physically, you know, how they engineered it and made it. But I think your point is a really good one, that it was actually psychologically, how did they decide to do this? How did they decide that it was so important to get right this crazy, enormous pyramid-shaped tomb, you know, over 460 feet high, towering into the sky, why it mattered to them? And for me, that was one of the reasons to write the book, was not just to celebrate these massive monuments, which are all huge and extraordinary, but try to work out what they meant to the people who created them, and therefore what they can mean to us now. And the Great Pyramids, you know, I know there are lots of interesting theories about the pyramids that the
just
aliens...
Just tell us, did aliens do it, Bettany? Did the aliens do it?
I can promise you the aliens did not do it. I've climbed down underneath the pyramid in this descending chamber. I've seen the handprints, the pickaxe marks. You know, I've physically witnessed and touched evidence that it was made by humans. So definitely not aliens. But I do think it was this kind of giant resurrection machine. So this idea that somehow through the pyramid, the great King Khufu, because we don't actually call them Pharaoh at this point, the great King Khufu could ascend to the stars and be part of the night sky in the cosmos and therefore live forever. And that would really have mattered to the ancient Egyptians, because for them, this is how the world turned, you know, that they needed to have this notion that everything was connected in the cosmos and the universe, and that it was only when their great king took his fitting place that fertility would come back to Egypt. So it was a building that fundamentally mattered to them. It gave them a sense that the world would still keep turning, which was why they had to get it right, why they had to make it almost perfect.
Now, I want to jump to the next one, which we kind of already touched on, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I'm just going to admit my ignorance here. Until I read your book, I just never got Hanging Gardens as a wonder. I'm just kind of, it's a garden. How interesting could it be? And then what I really didn't know until I read your book is, not only do we not know exactly where they were, but also if they were.
Yes.
That it's the only wonder we're not positive actually existed.
Yeah, that's right. And isn't that fascinating? Because of all of them, it's probably the most famous. So, you know, I conducted a very unscientific experiment when I was writing the book, because, you know, when you're a writer, you're just obsessed with your subject. And wherever I was, sitting on a bus or a train or in a bar, I'd end up talking to strangers and say, oh, what do you think of the Seven Wonders, and which is your most favorite, or, you know, which are you most interested in? And without exception, the first name that people came up with were the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And I think there's a reason for that. I think it's because we don't know exactly where they were, and therefore whether they existed or not. You know, I cannot put my hand on my heart and say this was 100% real, because we just don't have the archaeological evidence for it. We have lots of historical evidence, so we have lots of people from the ancient world who wrote about it, but we're waiting for that to come out of the Middle East, which I'm sure it will. I'm convinced we will find the Hanging Gardens. But because they've had this kind of mystique around them, and because people haven't been able to visit them in the kind of Victorian age or the Tudor age, they've captured the world's imagination. So we can create in our heads what these Hanging Gardens look like. And I wonder if that's one of the reasons why they've stayed so incredibly, incredibly popular. Yeah. But you're right, they were extraordinary. If you listen to the descriptions of them by ancient authors, they kind of reared up like a mountain out of the palace. They would have been, I imagine them being like sort of giant stacked window boxes. We have very detailed descriptions of how they were made, of the waterproofing that was used so that the plants would still grow, so that the water channels could water all the horticulture. And for me, one of the reasons they're so fascinating is whichever king it was who built them, whether it was Nebuchadnezzar the Great in Babylon or Sennacherib, the Assyrian king in further north in Nineveh, both those kings we know were basically kind of extreme gardeners. They were basically obsessed with proving that they could control the earth by moving not just plants, but whole trees from one place to another. I mean, it's really fascinating psychologically. So, you know, these are great military leaders. They have very successful campaigns. They take over other people's territories. They famously turn up in the Bible, both of them, in the way that they react with Judea and beyond. They enslave populations. But almost the most important thing for them to prove that they were omnipotent was the fact that they could physically move, as I said, whole forests from one place to another. They had dominion over nature, whereas the Great Pyramid was all about the pharaoh's involvement with the natural world. Once you get to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, it's proving that humans can recreate nature itself in the form of a garden. And so we have these amazing quotes from these kings saying, you know, I used my iron picks and I tore down mountains and I ripped up trees like matchwood and I shipped them, you know, from ebony and rosewood and acacia and boxwood. They sort of list all these things. So it's a very interesting to think that's why they would have been famous in their day, because only a great king like Nebuchadnezzar or Sennacherib could have had the power or ambition or sheer will or hubris, you might think, to try to move whole forests to create an ornamental garden.
Now, the next one. This one I remember from my childhood. So I'm in grade school, late 80s, early 90s. And back in the day, for our younger listeners, there was no Google. You had to go and find an encyclopedia to see anything. And I distinctly remember the first time I saw this wonder was this picture in an encyclopedia, this gigantic statue of a semi-naked guy straddling this channel into a bay. So the Colossus of Rhodes, I'm just going to ask this question, Bettany. I almost kind of want you to lie to me because I know what the answer is. Was the Colossus actually straddling the inlet to a bay?
I'm so sorry to, like, you know, ruin your day. The Colossus was not striding an inlet or even to, you know, two harbors in Rhodes, but he was still incredibly impressive. So, you know, this is a sculpture that's well over 100 feet tall, the bronze sculpture of the great sun god Helios, definitely straddling, or definitely legs akimbo. The straddling the harbour thing so that boats could go underneath, that was invented by an Italian lawyer who visited Rhodes in the 14th century, like, you know, 1400 years longer, actually, after the Colossus had fallen. He went, oh, I think this is how it worked. This seems like a very good, you know, this is how I can imagine it. And his ideas caught on. It's one of those terrible examples of people inventing history to match their kind of fantasy version of what the world is. So I'm afraid the Colossus didn't straddle the harbour with boats going in and out. Nice as an idea.
Dang it.
As it is. I'm really sorry. But it was an incredible structure, I think, because I've travelled to Rhodes, and I think that probably the sculpture stood on the top of on the kind of brow of the hill overlooking Rhodes Old Town. So there would have been almost like an optical illusion when you came in from the sea that it would have looked like it was standing astride the two harbours beneath. But it fell within either 50 or 57 years of being built, because it's very unstable. That's, if you imagine that extraordinary height of bronze sculpture and the fact that it was standing with its legs akimbo. So an earthquake felled it, and we know that people would go and visit the kind of fragments of the Colossus on the ground. So I'm really sorry it wasn't straddling the harbour, but it was still awesome and, you know, worth thinking about and writing home about.
I mean, that chapter was very interesting just because a lot of it was around the people of Rhodes and kind of war and how much of that kind of shaped who they were as a people and then why the Colossus would even exist under those circumstances.
Yeah.
I found that interesting because it's not something you see a lot of different places.
No, it's true. No, that's true. And it's exactly as you said, there was this terrible siege of the island of Rhodes, really debilitating. Many people died. Sieges are terrible things anyway. And basically the kind of powers of the world got together and said, well, this is not on, you know, we need to sort this out diplomatically. And a peace treaty is agreed. And what we're told is that as a sort of symbolic gesture, the siege machinery and some of the weapons were melted down, and that bronze was used to create the sculpture. So it was almost like a sort of peace statue, you know, proof that peace is possible, which is a very, very beautiful idea, even if it's not true. You know, it's a really beautiful idea. You know, all of these came from difficult times. You know, the ancient world was tough. There were famines around the corner, death, disease, you know, military attack, pirate raids. You know, it was not an easy time to live. And for me, it makes it even more impressive that people took time out of their busy, difficult days to dream up these extraordinary creations, and then to have the kind of technical sense to be able to design them and then actively build them.
Well, speaking of getting beat up, we have the statue of Zeus, which wasn't always treated nicely, I should say.
Yeah.
How about that one? What draws you to that one when you think about how do I present this to people? What makes this interesting? Because the Olympics do come up.
Yeah, they do. Well, it was the Olympic Games were founded to honor Zeus in his sanctuary in the mainland of Greece at Olympia. And it was, I mean, there's lots of things that are amazing about it. So it's this seated statue of the king of the gods seated in his temple. And again, just imagine how clever that is, because it's almost this notion of what happens when he stands up, the god, you know, he'll unroof the temple. So seated statue of Zeus covered with a ton of gold, a ton of hippopotamus ivory, these exquisite crystal decorations, and all of it reflected in like an infinity pool of olive oil beneath. So it would have looked like he was double height. So, I mean, it would have been an extraordinary piece of art to witness. It was actually, of all the wonders, this is the one that was written about more than anything else. And you get people like Epictetus, who's one of the founders of Stoicism, a freed slave who says, you know, basically you can die happy once you've seen the statue of Zeus at Olympia. So obviously really impressed the ancients, and was supposed to be very lifelike. It was this sort of image of Zeus with his sort of brow furrowed and his beard and kind of, you know, thundering with energy. And actually, we don't realize it, but we see that face of Zeus around us because it was the inspiration for a lot of the faces of Jesus that were then painted in Constantinople, because the statue itself was physically moved to ancient Constantinople, the sort of headquarters of Christianity. And that face was used as one of the models for Jesus in some of those buildings. So, you know, we're seeing the face of the statue of Zeus, even if we don't realize it. It was that impressive. It was an inspiration for one of the most important portraits of the late antique and medieval worlds.
And there's a theme in here with the book, and this chapter kind of brings it out too, especially the pyramid chapter as well, that kind of focus on the daily life for somebody who was just around one of these wonders. You really go into detail as much as possible about what a normal person might be doing around this time.
Yeah.
And for me, it was also very interesting because it made me think in my head, you know, somebody who's just writing in a diary today, a historian 1,000 years from now is going to find that to be absolute gold, just something so magnificent that their daily boring life might mean something, you know, to them it's boring, but to somebody 1,000 years ago, they're going to say, oh, this is how we know what things were like. This is a true artifact that makes us smarter. Was that something that for each wonder you kept running into that, or were you intending on doing that when you started?
Yeah, a really fantastic question. I think, you know, history is about people. So it's really important to populate history with the real people, not just the great and the good, but the everyday women and men on the street. And I think it was very important, particularly in this book, because when you say the seven wonders of the ancient world, I think sometimes people imagine they are fantasy and made up. But, you know, as you know, they're real places built by real people and visited by real people. So actually, the seven wonders list wasn't just a list, it was a kind of bucket list. It was like an ancient travel guide of where you should go and what you should see. So they're very important as places that were experienced by people. But you're absolutely right. Those tiny fragments of everyday lives, that's the thing that puts the colour into history. And as exactly as you say, you know, little details that we set down now will be gold dust for a historian in 1,000 years' time. So, you know, incredible accounts that we have of, there's this woman called Egeria, who was traveling in the 4th century AD, probably from a nunnery of some kind. We don't know whether she was a nun or a lay sister in Portugal. And she sort of sets off to travel through the Holy Land. And we hear her accounts of the Great Pyramid of Giza, for instance, and what it was like to do that traveling, you know. So we have these incredible eyewitness details. I mean, Egeria is very interesting as well, because Egeria, who says that the Great Pyramid was actually the granaries of Joseph, and that idea stuck as well. So you see in the medieval period, images of the pyramids, for instance, in St. Mark's in Venice, in that beautiful cathedral there, you can see the pyramid with these little windows and Joseph out standing outside with his, you know, his sheaves of wheat. So, you know, you have to sometimes read the sources carefully, but you're absolutely right. It's the... Everything matters, doesn't it? You know, you live a fuller life if you just really enjoy what everybody is doing around you, however significant or insignificant. And I always feel the same way with history. It's just life is a beautiful thing. People are beautiful creatures. And if you can be interested in the minutiae of their lives, then your life is made richer and more interesting.
Now, we've got two wonders left, and I'm saving my favorite for the last. So the next one is the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus. I tried to say that word like 5 times. It's just not coming out right.
You did it right.
Yes, nailed it. That's actually the one that when I try and list the 7, I don't know why that one always kind of falls out of my brain, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
But it's almost, I think, and this is just very ignorant of me, but I'm going to say it. Like the pyramids are in themselves a big mausoleum, so I think it almost feels redundant, but it shouldn't, right? Like this is a pretty impressive thing all by itself. That's why it's a 7 wonder, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. So the mausoleum named after King Mausolus, so it was his giant tomb. So all mausoleums in the world are named after this mausoleum. So it really matters. You know, so the Lincoln's Memorial in the US, that's based on the mausoleum of Halicarnassus. It's a mixture of that and the Statue of Zeus, interestingly. But yeah, that would have been crazy. So on the coast of what is now modern day Turkey, this kind of firework in the sky of painted, you know, statuary and sculpture, all coloured red and blue and a sort of beautiful gold colour. So it was an extraordinary monument. I've had the great fortune when I was travelling in Turkey to be invited down into a tomb beneath the earth, which was also built by Mausolus, in fact, for his father. It hadn't been opened for 2,300 years. So it was an incredible thing for me to, literally, I became Lara Croft for a moment when I went down to this tomb. You know, and just saw this beautiful sculpture and statuary. So I think when you think of the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, you have to think about it as this, you know, exquisite example of the best of all kinds of different styles. So Egyptian, Greek, local Carian, Persian, sort of all melded together into like a giant kind of wedding cake construction.
Okay, I don't want to, you know, short the mausoleum, but I want to get to mine.
Your favorite.
Yes, the Lighthouse at Alexandria. I love lighthouses now anyway, so of course, it's just going to follow that. A lot of people, I think about this, but it's hard. We see lighthouses today and we think about them, but obviously this lighthouse wouldn't exactly kind of look and work the way they would today. They are similar. How is it kind of different? What did the Lighthouse Alexandria actually look like?
So that it was, again, huge, I mean, really massively, extraordinarily tall, again, over 400 feet high, you know, 3 times the size of the Colossus of Rhodes. Again, slightly sort of wedding cake structure of different shapes, stacked one on top of the other. But I think covered in sort of crazy things. It came from that culture of Alexandria that loved moving machines and automata and sort of tricks. So we think that there were statues of Zeus up on the top, or possibly the sun god Helios, that would have rotated and probably had like conch shells, the fake conch shells that would have actually sounded out music. So it would have been really impressive. And the flame itself would have been, we know that there was room for donkeys to carry up fuel for the flame day in, day out. So it would have burnt and reached out across the night sky and across the sea. So, I mean, that must have been like nothing else anybody else had ever seen before, you know. So again, it's no surprise that people talked about Alexandria, and often when you have coins of Alexandria or images of it on a lamp, it's represented by an image of the lighthouse. It was kind of the symbol for the city. So super, super impressive. And I'd love to hear why it's your favourite. I love it because it welcomed in knowledge, because, you know, the docking tax for the city of Alexandria with the boats coming, you didn't pay money, you paid in papyrus scrolls, you know, you paid in ideas that were written down. Well, why is it your favorite?
I've always loved lighthouses. My family, we always went to Cape Cod in the summers. We had friends who had a place in Cape Cod. So I kind of grew up looking at lighthouses in the summer. So there's that emotional attachment to them. But also the thinking of that a lighthouse is created for a benevolent reason, to keep people safe out in the sea, letting them know where the dangers are and things like that. And, you know, Alexandria, as you were just mentioning, we do have to point out that while the lighthouse was kind of a benevolent thought process, there was quite a bit of documentary thievery going on, because a lot of these things that came in, apparently the Alexandrians said, oh yeah, we'll give that right back to you, we just want to copy it, but they would be keeping the originals, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then you'd get back a facsimile. I know, it was this, well, it's, you know, knowledge is power. And it was almost like Alexandria was like the kind of internet of the ancient world. So they did everything they could to keep all that knowledge. But one of the things I love about the lighthouse is there's an ancient author called Lucian of Samostata, who I'd have loved to have met. He's a really cool guy, really sort of wicked in his sense of humor. And he writes one of the world's first ever sci-fi novels. And he talks about the fact that this ancient astronaut flew up to the sky, looked down from space, and he recognized Earth because he could see the Colossus of Rhodes and the lighthouse of Alexandria. So those two wonders for him represented planet Earth.
Or maybe he just met the aliens that made the pyramids, Bethany.
Maybe. And they didn't mention the pyramids, so that would be there, you know, the plot thick.
Benny, I love spending time with the Seven Wonders. Now, I will say that there are people like myself that they remember history as having to go to school and just getting stuff stuffed in their heads, and now they think history is boring. These poor misguided souls, if I sat one of them in front of you and they said, Benny, history is boring, why should I read the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World? What would you say?
Well, just because life's not boring and history is just the best bits of life. So if you're getting kind of the cherry-picked version of the most wonderful things, the most extraordinary stories, the most exciting and dramatic characters, then what's not to resist? So I think you just have to remind yourself that history is the story of real people, real lives, real events. And this tells us about what it is to be human, in that we love to collaborate to create things. We love to work together to achieve beyond the possibilities of the individual. And we love privilege and beauty and inspiration and ambition. So I hope that if people read this book, they'll find that the history that I'm writing about is a very hopeful place.
Well, Bethany, I love the book. Thank you so much for coming on. This was an absolute pleasure.
Total delight to chat to you, and hopefully we'll meet in person soon.
Hope so. And that's it for this episode. Bethany, thank you so much. Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. If Bethany's has anything to do with it, trust me, you're going to love it. Hit us up Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Don't forget the YouTube channel. Until next time, nerds, stay cool.